Morbid. So today I'd like to explore. I don't know if it's less morbid or more morbid than brain death. You can't win over here. End of life issues. The good news is we're almost done with the end of life topics. So in a short order, we're going to be moving on to new horizons and looking at some of the fascinating innovations and really miraculous opportunities that we have in the world today in terms of fertility. It's going to be incredible. I'm very excited about it. We're going to look at all those kinds of issues, and it should be a lot of fun. And it's coming to us at this point in this course. That's it. So initially I was going to go the other way around, but there was a request, I don't know if anyone here, but from some people who come especially to the evening one, to start with end-of-life issues. As they feel like it's the stage of life where they are, it's often with parents, like a lot of people thinking in terms of their parents, that kind of thing. So it's the benefit is that there's unfortunately there's a practical side to that, but it's also sometimes it's time to move on to something else. So it's gonna be great. Anyhow, so today I wanna start with a personal recollection, which I will, God willing, so long as my brain is functioning at a high level and I'm not at the end of life care stage, that I will always remember a number of years ago when I served as it wasn't too close to home, but in an unusual way it came close to home. I served as rabbi, as I think many know, of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine synagogue, the student community. And the community for many years did not have a great option for tefillah. We had an upstairs penthouse on the 28th floor of one of the three major skyscraper student dorm buildings that they had built in the 1970s.
I'm sorry, this is Albert Einstein Medical School?
New York. Yeah, it's confusing here in Philly with Einstein Hospital here. Now it's technically no longer Yeshiva Universities, but it's...
How do you get there on Shabbos if you live on the first floor?
If you live... hold on. So I'm coming to... I'll answer that in just a moment. Right? So you think do you like the Upper West Side? But that's actually not what we did. So on weekdays, we davened in the penthouse. It didn't have enough space for Shabbat tefillah anyway. So even if we could work out the Shabbos elevator or something like that, it wouldn't have worked. And for Shabbat, we davened at the Lubin Cafeteria, which was, which is all of a block away. And it was beautiful, and we stored in our own Kodesh and Sidurim and even a couple of Svarim there, and it was very, very nice. But it wasn't our own space. And a number of times a year, typically, we would have to relocate because there was another event that was taking place there. And so it was not a perfect solution. And so finally, we got to a point where there was someone who was very involved administratively on the medical school side who was able to help to begin the process of looking at really constructing our own space, our own shul that would work for everything. We wouldn't rely on the penthouse. We wouldn't have to take these 7 minutes in a stretch trips upstairs and downstairs. And in fact, there was even a story of a group that was going up at one point on a Sunday afternoon to daven mincha on the 20th floor, and the elevator, of course, got stuck. And there is this legendary mincha minion that took
the elevator,
right?
And
also a new Gentile friend who got to learn all about the Jewish prayer practices. It was. The Gemara says that in the Beit HaMikdash, that on the high holidays when everyone came to visit, that kind of thing, Omdim Tzefufim U'Meshachavim Revachim, they would stand in very tight quarters, but it felt miraculously as if so. No, it was not. It is not a very large elevator. But
they just told that guy they're praying for the elevator to start.
And that they had plenty to pray for, that's for sure. There's another story of someone came for an interview, and actually on his way up for the medical school interview, I think he actually got trapped. Can you imagine? Cool. Now it's not on right? But can you imagine how stressful, right? Yeah. Anyhow, so I think that was long before the days of smartphones too. So he only hoped that they'd heard about it in the whole nine yards. Anyhow, so we were looking at new possibilities of building a real solution, a real space of our own. And initially, the suggestion was that there's a building named the Van Etten Building. that is right on campus, about actually 50 yards or so away from the dorms. I was right there, and that might be a possibility. And in fact, from my window, there's the rabbi's apartment, traditionally in Einstein, and still is, 1945 East Chester Road, apartment 4A. That's where we lived. And I happened to be that 1945 East Chester 4A. The direction that particular apartment looked out over was out toward the Van Etten building. Not only did you look out toward the Van Etten building, but if you take a look at the Van Etten building, if you knew where you were looking, you actually could see that on the basement floor, which actually was visible from there, because there's a sharp decline at that point, there's a little hill there, you can actually see the local morgue. On one of the, because right, you had a number of local hospitals that were right there. You had Weiler, which is the Einstein Hospitals associated with the medical school, and then you had Jacoby Medical Center, which is right there. Many people went on to do residencies there as part of the Montefiore system, and so you had all the that's what you had. And the proposal to build the new shul was basically a floor up and a number of hallways over. So there is a halakhi question about the permissibility. I had to answer. So the executive dean of Einstein says, Rabbi Sinensky, you're the duly appointed rabbi for the community. I need your halakhic ruling on whether or not this is a permissible place for Kohanim to daven. Is this an issue? And so I researched the question and had to look into it. In the end, it was a moot point because we found a much better location and it went away. But for about a month and a half, I recall looking out constantly, almost obsessively at the morgue. Here out, you know, like the venue. How many doors would be closed? How many times? The whole complex halakha calculus in terms of how to work this out. But yeah, they performed autopsies there on the whole 9 yards, and that was it. The other experience was that for 4 months of your first year of medical school, you'd be in an anatomy lab for almost the entire time. And so this became the topic of conversation at Shabbat tables, because either they were meeting the cadaver, which is quite the experience for a medical student to meet your cadaver. It's considered humanizing to interact beforehand, and there are all sorts of psychological reactions that it elicits from the students, and nervous laughter and awkward jokes and just silence. It's a very powerful and emotionally overwhelming from an experience. And then they would transition, they would just start take the course, and then it would just be a normal part of your Shabbos table talk, because that's just what the students were doing. And here we are, you know, it's very interesting to be a non-medical student who's talking about anatomy, you know, lab for 4 months, you know, and the whole night. It's very interesting experience.
Medical. Jefferson, medical humanities.
Yes, I know you teach the medical humanities course, right?
Unfortunately, I'm not squeamish.
Okay. So yeah, that's helpful for these kinds of things.
Anatomy lab several times.
Yeah, I did a visit.
I forgot to bring it today. I'll mail it to you if you ever want to mail it out to the people. There are two very striking poems about autopsies that I introduced into the introduction of the anatomy class.
Ooh.
And students were very grateful about it. But jumping the gun a little bit, just want to say the two professors who led the class were extraordinarily humanistic. No jokes allowed. No, mm-hmm. They set a tone.
Mm-hmm.
And the philosophy is that the cadaver is the first patient. Mm-hmm. When I first heard that, I thought, what's he talking about? The, you know, it can't talk, it can't.
Mm-hmm,
but that's
mm-hmm,
the point,
mm-hmm,
that because it is totally helpless, mm-hmm. how you treat something that's totally helpless,
mm-hmm.
will influence, but you could make
it's
the
part of your education.
Stuff,
right? Yeah, that's right.
They keep sore.
Wow.
So I was there the first day, and then I went around, and then I would come back periodically. One time I was there, big hoo-ha-ha, in the right-hand back table, 6 people. They had turned a cadaver over, because they were up to that in the course, and the person had a huge I don't know how to say it politely yet. I just don't know the medical term. Hunchback. What would you call it?
Kyphosis.
Whatever. Anyway, what was amazing was that the students were practically in awe and felt so lucky. Look, we get to see something like that. We get to see how it develops and grows. And I thought to myself, I am sure that this woman, it was a woman, did not have that kind of reception when she walked down the street.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
It was fascinating.
Very interesting.
I wrote about it.
It's very beautiful. Oh,
it was.
So, Emily, I would be very interested, to see the two poems, if you would honor me by sending them to me. If you remember, I'd be very appreciative.
It's short and very pointed.
And if you publish something on this experience, I would also be honored to see that as well.
The other thing I have to say, because it is on the back of my mind, and I think some people here remember, many moons ago, there was a doctor, as a matter of fact, who died mysteriously. She was sick. Mm-hmm. She had all the tests. The tests showed nothing. She was getting a little yellow, but somehow it didn't show up on the test.
Mm-hmm.
And she died. Mm. And her husband, who was a chemist, specifically very much wanted an autopsy.
I'm sure that was not permitted.
No, that was not permitted.
Mm-hmm.
If you die under mysterious circumstances, isn't it the medical examiner wants an autopsy?
We don't go into the details.
It wasn't permitted religiously or for medical reasons?
No, it wasn't religiously.
But a mysterious death.
I have no idea. It's complicated, so let's get there.
She was well one day, and she was gone within a week.
It was
a horrible situation.
Hmm.
And she was in her 50s,
right.
I would say.
Early 50s. It created an enormous amount of bitterness in her husband, who was remarried. Was really, I'm just going to say it, fed up with Orthodoxy.
She
didn't grow up in that home in the first place. She was the drive. But this, he was.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm mentioning it.
Every stringency has a leniency. We should always know that there are costs and benefits to all sides in all scenarios, and it's a question of weighing the considerations.
Right.
So,
it's
a very important yisod. It's a very important principle. There's no such thing as a stringency that doesn't come. There are always life. The nature of life is that there are always costs and benefits, and we have to maturely weigh the options and judge as best we can. But it's not. That is very interesting. I can appreciate that.
So he wanted the autopsy.
Oh,
yeah.
Because his wife died under serious circumstances, wants to know what was going on.
Yeah.
That was not picked up by the tests.
It sounds like a medical examiner's case.
20 years ago, 30 years ago,
not 30.
Now,
this
you're
talking about?
Yeah.
This was
2000. You know, the husband didn't poison her. I mean, if you don't do an autopsy.
Unfortunately, she, I knew her, and
so
I was in a vela, and she came to my father's shiva, like a week before she became ill, and so I basically said cottage with her children, and I remember.
Oh, of course.
But she was extremely kind to my father also.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Okay, beginning of life, here we go. All right. An advertisement. All right. So what's interesting is that it's certainly immediate for our communities, but historically also, when the State of Israel was just being conceived and founded, the question of how to run the medical schools in accordance with halakha and how that might be done was another kind of flashpoint for these kinds of conversations, and that's what we're going to look at as well, so it should be very interesting. So what are the halachic issues involved? We can imagine what the medical benefits might be, but what are the halachic potential pitfalls or challenges here? So there's a classic contemporary work called the Nishmat Avraham. That's what I gave you in source one. The Nishmat Avraham is written by Rabbi Doctor, easy to remember, Avraham. Okay. I understand that he was here a number of years ago, and he's considered one of the most renowned authorities. By the way, this is not as well known. Rav Ovadia Yosef. Actually, his middle name and his family's last name are both Yosef. At least when they came from, he was born in Cairo, I want to say, when he was like 4, he came to Israel. And his family, I believe, took the last name Yosef, which made him Ovadia Yosef. Yosef. but he thought that that might be a little bit confusing or a little bit much, so he simply shortened it to Ovadia Yosef. But this has happened before. But Rabbi Avraham, or Dr. Avraham, lists 5 basic potential halachic objections to this. So he says, Limud chokhmat harifua, the study of medicine. He says, in this regard, hasibot shedanam b'ma poskim asrani tuchim etim hemis. The considerations based on which the halachic authorities considered the possibility of prohibiting dissection of the dead are A, disgracing the corpse, called nivul hameit. The second one is hana'a min hameit. So in other words, dissection can disfigure and therefore disrespect the body, which is a halachic prohibition. The second one, B, deriving benefit from the dead, what we call hana'a min hameit. This is an interesting one, less obvious. There's actually a prohibition to not, it might be another aspect of respecting the corpse, but it's actually prohibited, according to the Gemara, to benefit from a corpse. Probably as a sign of respect. But it appears in the Gemara, which is very interesting. And there are discussions, so what does that mean for deriving medical information? Is that the kind of benefit? Or no, we're talking about using and misusing, a body that has sacredness and to use it for some ephemeral, temporal, other purpose, which thereby disrespects the dead. The third one, nullifying the obligation of burial. There's an obligation to bury. The Gemara says that, the Torah says, rather, there's an obligation to bury a person on that day. We don't delay Jewish burials unless it's necessary as a general matter. And so if we keep the corpse around, and we're going to dissect it. So we're talking about donating to medicine or even in terms of autopsies. So that's another potential prohibition here. The fourth, and this is a variation on these themes, he says, is Kiddushat Hameit, the sanctity of the dead, which again is treated separately in the halachic literature, but is obviously a variation of those same themes. And this is the only one I would say is somewhat mystical in nature, which is that in Hebrew, kasheh l'nefesh hameit, it's difficult for the dead person's soul, literally. What would that mean? So this is more of, again, of a mystical kind of idea, but there are some authorities that talk about the notion that leaving a person with proper dignity and proper peace, as it were, is not only a way of respecting the body, but somehow has an impact on the soul from a mystical perspective. And so if that's the case, then it would be to somehow disrupt the peaceful departure of the soul. You have in the Gemara already, and in the rabbinic literature, ideas that are perhaps not fully comprehensible, someone who's not steeped in mystical traditions, but the idea that the soul hovers near the body for a certain amount of time, it's related to Shiva, it's related to Kaddish, and so on and so forth. So these kinds of ideas that somehow there could be some sort of impact on the soul. And there's a question here of mind-body connection in the Jewish tradition, which is a very profound one and is quite powerful. But that's the direction which this would potentially go. So these are all potential barriers to performing an autopsy or to engaging in medical dissection or donating a body to medicine. What would be the Jewish perspective on this if someone wanted to do so? With our students, we talk about Jeremy Bentham. Jeremy Bentham is a famed 19th century British ethicist and thinker who was the godfather of what's called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism basically says if we want to make decisions on an individual ethical basis, on a national basis, whatever it might be, we need to judge the outcomes. It's almost like a calculus of happiness. How much joy, how much happiness will this bring to different parts of the population? I don't particularly like Bentham because he said we should do this for the entire male population. That's what he said. It's the 19th century. You could get away, you could try to get away with such things. He was very progressive, except his calculus. He said, oh, we'll worry about the men and the women not so much. And others, including the next generation of ethicists like John Stuart Mill and other famous voices, they said, you can't have it both ways. Either you're interested in the happiness of the entire population, right, or you're not being very progressive here. So he got in some hot water for that. But Bentham, actually, his utilitarian, said, I'm going to actually donate my body to medicine, and you can actually still view Jeremy Bentham today in London. I kid you not. So this, you know, what would halacha say about such an unusual decision? So there are... what I want to do is to give you two quick dueling passages from the Gemara that bear on this, and then I want to survey basically a key source that leads to these discussions, the contemporary discussions of autopsies, and then to essentially look at three classical positions, a stringent position. This is somewhat simplified, but generally we can identify three camps. So we can identify a camp that is opposed to autopsy in many ways, a camp that is much more permissive, and especially was permissive around the time of the founding of the State of Israel, and then a third camp that raises the possibility, but then is hotly disputed by others, might there be a difference between the laws that govern Jewish and Gentile corpses. And some say, advocate for such a position, and some say that's not Jewish, we don't accept that at all, and push back very hard. And then at the very end, we're going to look at, we've seen the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer of Oldenburg, who was the rabbi for Shaar Tzedek Hospital, and one of the great halachic authorities in medical ethics in the 20th century. We'll conclude by looking at his view. So that's kind of the quick framework for us. So let's pick it up with those original Talmudic sources. I'll give them to you in summary and read just a little bit of them, but you have them here for reference on the page sources 2 and 3. So those who end up being more lenient in terms of autopsies point to source 2, and I'll give you the context here.
Sorry, can you just tell me what was the date roughly of the first source?
Oh, he's still living, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was very recent.
Published this... now is it maybe 15, 20 years ago? I forget the exact date of publication. All right, so the Gemara in Masechet Bava Batra, the Gemara here is talking about a debate among inheritors and essentially a scenario in which in order to... for whatever set of reasons, actually, in order to settle a monetary dispute, it actually became necessary to perform, not an autopsy, but to somehow dismember the dead person. It was contingent on physical characteristic, and the only way to do that was to exhume and to examine physically the body. So the question was, is that a legitimate way or mechanism for determining or deciding a dispute among the inheritors? So the Gemara says, if you would have asked me, is it permissible to perform an autopsy in order to settle a dispute among inheritors, among the what we call the Yorshim, I would have been very skeptical. That's what I would have thought. The Gemara actually suggests at one point that it should be halachically permissible. It doesn't mean it's recommended. It doesn't mean we wouldn't try to talk the family members out of this, but the Gemara unexpectedly actually suggests, at least in one place, the Gemara says, if that's what's necessary to do so, to do this, the Gemara says, then last words in the Gemara, let him be disgraced. The Gemara says, linval v'linval. This is the last Hebrew words about this. In order to resolve the dispute, the Gemara says it would be legitimate to do this. This Gemara is really unexpected, or for me was unexpected, and seems to suggest that in order to settle a monetary dispute, we could go ahead with some sort of dismembering or at least exhuming of the body.
Can you explain what circumstance might...
I forget the exact argument that they were debating, you know, that they were judging, but there was some sort of condition that was built. If I deteriorate to a certain point, then somehow, I think it had to do with, I don't remember for sure, maybe it had to do with
who cares for.
Yeah, that was the issue. And then there were ramifications that came from the physical Yeah, unusual kind of scenario. So anyhow, but the point is, for our purposes, that the Gemara is suggesting that for financial purposes, that it might be permissible to do so. So now, if you want to know, for example, can we learn medically, right? Not just what happened to a particular individual, but can we benefit for the future of science or something like that? So you might make an argument that's essentially a fortiori. It's like what we call in the Gemara's language, a kal vachomer, right? All the more so, right? In other words, if to settle a monetary dispute, we can do so. Then in order to learn and benefit for medical purposes, and perhaps all the more so. So we're going to see that Chief Rabbi Uziel, who's the first Sephardic chief rabbi of the state of Israel, relied in particular on the source. And he says, you see from here that as much as this is a prohibition, it's a rabbinic prohibition to dismember the body in this way. And you're going to see why he thought it was only a rabbinic prohibition. And therefore, he said, under specific circumstances, it might be permissible to be lenient in this regard. And therefore, he was willing to be more lenient in terms of how to structure the medical schools in Israel. And in fact, it was on the basis of some of his rulings that many practices were put in place until today in terms of what's done, what's performed in Israeli medical schools. Very interesting. On the flip side, there was another case in the Gemara in Chulin, which seems to go in the opposite direction. The Gemara there on 11b at Aleph from the Bez, source 3, the Bez at the bottom of the first side, the Gemara talks about here is a case where you have a possibility of a murder case. And we know that that it's considered to be murder. You just kill someone who's otherwise healthy, but the Gemara raises the possibility that there's always a chance that the individual is already ill in some way. And we know that the halacha is that if you actually have, even if it's a far-fetched scenario, but if we know with some confidence that the individual who was killed was already, for medical reasons, as it were, condemned to death or expected to pass within 12 months, such an individual is viewed in halacha as a treifa, someone who's already condemned to be dying. And although obviously it's a horrific thing to do, it would not incur the same death penalty as it would for a typical scenario of murder. It's actually a halachic difference, because to some degree the person is already considered to be dying. Now, how you fit that in with some of what we talked about in terms of pulling the plug, etc., is a huge literature. It's unexpected, and it's certainly prohibited. It's biblically prohibited, but it's not of quite the same order. Unexpected. It's a very interesting thing. So the Gemara says, well, if you have that possibility, then we should examine the person to check whether or not, if there's reason to think that maybe this person, the victim, was somehow ill or had some physical condition that might have suggested that this person was already dying, as it were, so then maybe that's something that we could investigate. And the Gemara talks about whether or not that's incredibly unlikely and therefore ridiculous. But the Gemara says you can't just dismember this person. That's a terrible thing to do. The Gemara says, v'chi teman, if you're going to say the bad kinonly that we examine this individual, kaminval, this person is thereby disgraced. Is thereby disgraced. And the Gemara says you can't do that. That's a terrible thing to do. So in other words, here the Gemara is talking about in terms of determining whether or not there's a death penalty. And the Gemara says, is it permissible to dismember for that purpose? Absolutely not. That's not legitimate. So the others come along and they cite this Gemara and they say, wait a second, you can't just go ahead with this because it's disgracing the bodies. It's not an acceptable practice. So these two Gemara are often held up as sort of conflicting their intention with one another, and we could try to resolve it, or we could say that there's just a dispute among the various Gemara, but one seems to suggest that for financial reasons it might be legitimate to do so, and the other suggests that in order to determine whether or not someone has the death penalty, it would not be legitimate to exhume the body and to examine it physically, and you might have to cause some sort of, it might have to be some surgery, as it were, in order to get there. So these Gemarot very often are viewed as sort of the two classical sources and in tension with one another. And looking at these in context, the next source is one of the most pivotal for our discussions, and that's source 4. Source 4 comes from the Noda B'Yehuda. The Noda B'Yehuda was the great chief rabbi of the community in Prague and the surrounding areas in the 18th century, Rabbi Chizkiel Landau. Rav Yechezkel Landau was inquired in one of his most well-known responsa. He was inquired, queried about exactly this issue. And he says, the scholars of the city were asked if it is permissible to dissect the body of the dead in this place, in his community, or in a particular community that was under the aegis of his halachic authority, in order to see the source of the wound, in order to derive knowledge for the behavior of doctors from now on. In other words, at this point, autopsies had increasingly become the norm, and so came to the Jewish community, and there was an individual who had passed away, and it came to this question. So the Noda of Yehuda, in this case, Rav Yechezkel Landau, rules stringently on this question, and he says there's a difference between two scenarios. He says, in one case, we have a patient right in front of us, and we believe, and of course, in most circumstances, this is not the case. But he says, imagine for a moment that we were able to say with confidence that if we perform a medical examination of a corpse, of a person who has already passed away, and we're going to derive that from that medical knowledge, something that could plausibly, even if it's far-fetched, but could plausibly end up saving the life of a living patient who's right in front of us, who might be suffering from the same mysterious malady, but we see these striking similarities between the two. And remember, this is from the 18th century. Medical knowledge wasn't what it is today, clearly. And we think that we could actually extrapolate something really significant from this, says the Noda of Yehuda. In that case, what would the halacha be? Absolutely. You'd be obligated to go ahead with this, because there you can actually save a life. He says, this, however, is different. We don't have another patient right in front of us. This is long-term medical knowledge that's not considered, in his terminology, a chole shebefoneinu, a sick person who is in front of us right now, for whom we could derive immediate medical knowledge that could be immediately applicable. We don't have that here. So he says, it doesn't work. He says, but in this case, he continues later on in the responsum, there is no patient who needs this. It's just that we want to acquire this knowledge in the case that a patient before us who needs this. For this purpose, we do not push off, due to this small likelihood, any biblical or rabbinic prohibition. And he goes on to say that, in his opinion, this is so problematic that even the Gentile authorities, who were more lenient on autopsies during his day, would not permit such a thing. He says it is forbidden to permit this matter. Even the Gentile physicians do not perform experiments with dissection upon any corpse, with the exception of those killed by the law, or with those who have agreed to this during his lifetime, or one who agreed to this during his lifetime. So killed by the law. Used to be what?
Executed.
Right?
So the person is probably a murderer.
Oh, so thereby has forfeited their own right. Yeah, this was a common kind of thing, and for better or for worse, we know that in some of these exhibitions, the bodies exhibit and these kinds of things, there have been very serious ethical questions that have been raised, because ad hayom hazeh, until today, you have political executions, right? And places like China or whatever it might be, that then all of a sudden, mysteriously, these bodies for the appropriate fee might end up at an exhibition before you. And I remember when the bodies exhibit was up I was in New York. It was here, but I was here, but I think at the time I was in New York when I first encountered this question, and rumors started going around, and
They have exposed mummies in the museum now, in the Natural History Museum in Washington.
So there are.
And I was wondering.
There are common questions there. So there's some debate around these kinds of issues. The questions that come up also in terms of school trips. So we have these kinds of things. It's not such a simple matter. Goes back to the Einstein question. It's quite a similar set of debates. There's a debate about whether the laws of ritual purity and impurity are the same for Jewish and Gentile corpse. Clearly, they all convey a certain amount of impurity, but whether or not the laws are the same or somewhat different in terms of what's called tumat ohel, in terms of conveying impurity when you're simply in the same airspace, under the same overhang, for coming to be in that same physical space, there's some debate about that goes back for 1,000 years plus. Really, it's actually in the Gemara already. It's a Tanaitic debate. Vedas. It's almost 2,000 years already that there's been a debate around this. But there's different opinions in terms of how to rule on that. So that's a question too. So he says those are the only two scenarios in which the secular contemporary governments of his time would permit a commitment to this, but they wouldn't allow it in this case. He says, if we haven't forbid our lenience in this matter, they will, says, it's going to lead, it's going to open the floodgates. So they will come to dissect all corpses in order to learn the arrangement of the inner limbs and their natures, so we'll know how to cure the living. He says, he grants that this is a legitimate purpose, and of course we know that this is something that is very common in medical schools. When Dr. Reichlin was here last year, he lectured on this in Padua and other places. I think it was the 17th century was talking about. There's some fascinating literature about this whole question of, you know, the medical school question and the Cohen kind of scenario, or just in general, is this permissible? When is this permissible? And there were many who said that it would be permissible, because those who heard Rabbi Sachs last night, Jewish doctors, right? That's just the way that we're born. So the what was it? Goldberg? Stuart Goldberg? I forget.
The David? The birth of Dr. Michael Goldberg.
Whatever it was. He's so good. And here I am, I became a rabbi. All right, so the Noda Bihuda becomes, you can see why this is such a formative and such a sort of a pivotal response on these kinds of questions, because this becomes kind of the bar. So what's considered before us, what's not before us, and those, you can see how those who are stringent took this as their cue. And they said, look, it's one thing to, if you actually have a patient in front of us, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about medical schools, talking about university hospitals also, where you have ongoing medical research. So that's not enough to, certainly there's a benefit, he acknowledges, no question, that we can grow in our understanding from this, but he says it's not, it doesn't justify that case. Of course, the inverse implication is clear. And the next source five, the Chatam Sofer, who is predominantly the 19th century, the Chatam Sofer, says that this is, this can, indeed, he ruled practically, he said, that if there was that choleh b'faneinu, if there's the corpse in front of us, there's no question that that would be permissible. So according to this, if there was before us a sick person with a similar wound, so in other words, to the person, similar to the person who passed away, they wish to dissect the corpse for the sake of healing another, it's almost certainly permissible. However, he reiterates, in our case, he who wishes a similar scenario, he wishes to say, he's talking about someone, can you sell yourself for medical research? The selling yourself piece is interesting that he used that language and raises a whole set of other questions, you know, organ sales and all these very very murky kinds of things, kinds of practices. He says, but he wishes to sell himself alive to the doctors, they can dissect him after his death to learn from him the laws of medicine. Such an individual does not enter the class of saving a life at all. So again, this becomes the source for the stringent school. So they take their cue from this responsum of the Noda Bihuda, who said, look, it's just not sufficiently correlated. And you see this in a number, in a whole line, and I gave you a couple of these. I won't read this inside, but you have these here. So the Chazon Ish, Rav Karelitz, who was one of the great halachic authorities of the 20th century, the Chazon Ish rules based on this, and he cites the Noda Bihuda and the Chatam Sofer and says, look, he says it's not going to be permissible. And the way that he explains it is actually interesting. He says, well, read a little bit of it. He said, on the fourth line, he says, the difference between the two scenarios, the one where they say that it's permissible and the case where they say it's impermissible, he says, the difference is not between there being a sick person before us and there not being a sick person before us, but whether it is common. Whether it is common. Now, what does that mean, whether or not it's common? And then he cites from parallel source that he was discussing around sounding trumpets in cases of emergency. But what does that mean? He says, it's not a physical question. You might have misunderstood, he says. He says, it's not about whether or not there's actually someone before us versus someone who's not in front of us. What's the critical consideration here? He says, how likely is this discovery to lead to a medical breakthrough or something like that? He says, look, if we have someone in front of us, then there's really a concrete scenario in which we can really imagine to ourselves that we're actually going to be able to save a life. However, he says, if it's just some far-flung, you know, you can learn from anything. Okay, you can learn from anything, but it's what we're talking about before. It's cost-benefit ratio. He says, maybe you'll learn something, but it's not likely enough that at that point we're going to suspend biblical and rabbinic prohibitions of disfiguring and ultimately disgracing a corpse. So taking a look at the balance between the five considerations that the Nishmat Avraham, Rabbi Dr. Avraham outlined at the outset for us, right, that the different considerations in terms of disgracing and not burying the body and so on and so forth, he says at this point it's not going to be defensible.
The last couple of lines in the first paragraph,
yeah,
he's drawing a distinction between being attacked by an army, and I think he's pointing towards a plague.
Right.
If a plague breaks out in the city,
right,
then I think he might be saying that it's permissible.
Right, because there's something concrete, and we actually think that this is going to make a difference.
Yeah.
Right? And that's in terms of prayer as well, right? In other words, do we violate Shaban if we believe in the efficacy of prayer? So then prayer, it's not the same as medical intervention, but there's a way in which that would be permissible for the sake of saving life. It would be the same principle, he says. And then he follows that logic through. Yeah.
Do all these prohibitions pertain equally to non-Jews?
The prohibitions on... So we're going to come to... that's a debate. We're going to get there. I have a bunch of sources about that. That's a great question. That's, I mentioned at the end, that there's this in-between possibility. That's the three positions: the stringent, the lenient, and then the one that raises the possibility that is there a distinction between how the law is governing a Jewish Gentile corpse. So that's where we're going to go there. And then a little bit earlier, or somewhat earlier than the Chazon Ish in source 7, not going to go into it now, but there's a response of the Binyan Zion. The Binyan Zion is written by a 19th century German rabbi, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger is one of my favorite, but I really enjoy studying him for a number of reasons. One of them is because of the name of his work, Binyan Zion, the rebuilding of Zion. Why did he name his book this way? He was a proto-Zionist. It was before the Zionist movements really got started and underway. But he explored quite seriously, living off in Germany, halachic questions having to do with the nascent proto-Zionist movement in the 19th century. He asked questions such as, well, before, again, Herzl or any of these people came to the scene, he is asking, for example, his first responsum, actually, in the entire collection deals with the question of, can we offer, theoretically, it's a purely theoretical question, and the politics were obviously very different, at that time, says, could we theoretically offer the Korban Pesach on Har HaBayit nowadays without a temple?
Wow, that's pretty
good. All right, okay. Now, in 2018, you know, okay, all right, good. But, well, at that time, though, think about it. In the mid, I don't remember exactly what year that response was published, but if you're in the mid-1800s, I mean, it wasn't really, you know, politically sensitive. And not, certainly not in the same way. I mean, I'm sure it would have been complicated, but it not the same kind of thing. The Turks were. It was a very different kind of situation there. So he's very interesting, and he's inspiring, though, in that he was addressing Zionist kinds of themes long before the movement crystallized, and it's very beautiful. Yeah, he discusses this, and he introduces a curveball, which is it's always striking, and I never fully understood. There is an opinion, according to Rashi, there's a passage in the Gemara in Masechet Bava Kama, on Daf Samech, on page 16 Bava Kama. Based on Rashi's reading that particular Gemara, the suggestion that theft is actually might not be permissible, even in order to save a life. That's shocking. Theft might not be permissible in order to save a life. Why do I say that? That's shocking. Because one of the axioms of all of our study has been that with the exception of the big three, namely illicit relations, murder, and idolatry, that other than that, pikuach nefesh overcomes everything, even Shabbat. And the rabbis disputed that with early groups in the late Second Temple period and the like, but that's the halacha, that's what we accept. So this whole notion is very, very unexpected, and there's a whole literature about this. It's relevant to, you know, the organ discussions and all these kinds of things. But he thinks that there might be another problem with performing an autopsy. He thinks that it actually might, without permission, it might be considered to be theft. And the relatives don't necessarily have the ability. Does a relative have that right after a person passes away? It's not so simple. It's not so simple at all. that someone else has the right to, you know, to make that decision for you on your behalf, even though you're, by definition, incapacitated, i.e. and no longer here to make the decision. So that's a curveball as well. So he's also part of the stringent camp, although he introduces this consideration.
But it differentiates between those who will their bodies.
Good. So it might end up in a little bit of a different place, though. That's correct. And it might allow for... That's correct. Yes. And it might allow for that. And we're going to come back to that that idea as well. And we're going to see that Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Altenberg, actually introduces that as a consideration, as a practical halacha. And this is his ruling for Shari Tzedek Hospital, so it's quite practical for today. So this is you have the Novi Yehudah, you have this entire stringent camp, but then there were others with a very different perspective. And this is camp number two. If you take a look at source 8, I gave you the Mishpatei Uziel, Rav Ben Tzion Uziel, I mentioned as the first Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel. He's interesting because he's recently been championed as someone who was relatively lenient and welcoming in terms of matters of conversion. He has been at the forefront of those who want to have more lenient conversion standards for Russians, Ethiopians in Israel. He's often been cited. And he was posed this question as the chief rabbi. And he says that in his opinion, actually, there's a lot of room for leniency. However, in truth, as a matter of law, we have already written that we can derive from the above discussions of the Talmud that the entire prohibition of desecration only applies when it is intended for the purpose of disgrace, or its nature is that of desecration, disgrace, and has no value for others. But anything performed for the sake of the benefit of the community, and all the more so to save lives, was never stated from the outset. He says, wait a second, this is not desecration of the dead, in his opinion, and we can debate this. He says, desecration of the dead does not mean the physical act of dismembering. Rather, it means treating it with disrespect. If we perform, he's talking about dissection for medical purposes, or even, presumably according to him, and actually this is his ruling, I believe, echoing others also a few decades before him, if it's in order to learn medical information about even this individual, that's not disrespect. It's a sign of respect. We're trying to understand. We're trying to learn. We're trying to give a certain sense of dignity to passing this individual and understanding a sense of closure to the family as well. He says these potentially are not considered to be acts of desecration. Now, this is considered to be a minority view. I don't want to misrepresent this as the generally accepted one, but it's an important halachic voice in our tradition, and it has carried some sway, and it has support, as he points out in another passage in this response, from the Gemara that I quoted in Bava Batra, because that was the Gemara that said that if for financial reasons it might be permissible. He says, well, why would we permit that for financial reasons? If you can permit it for financial reasons, then if it's for any legitimate purpose, we have to define what legitimate is, but if deciding a dispute among the inheritors is a legitimate way of deciding this issue, then presumably all the more so that learning about, learning medical information and so on and so forth, it could be a legitimate reason as well. So that's Rav Uziel's claim. That's his argument. Rav Gorin, never one to avoid controversy. Rav Gorin stepped in here as well. He ruled leniently. Rav Gorin, for him and others, but especially for Gorin, this is part of his larger thesis about how halacha needs to just be looked at differently in context of matters of state. You know, Rav Gorin made arguments that were very different in their nature than his contemporaries. He said, look, it can't be that halacha, which was built ideally for the Jews entering the land of Canaan, it's meant to be a functioning, living kind of system in the land of Israel. He says, you know, for example, I don't remember if he actually makes this argument in another context, but the kind of argument that he would have made is, can you imagine, you know, having a state of Israel without, you know, a firefighting force and, you know, these kinds of things. You know, what are we going to do? Like, have these debates? You know, that's ridiculous. It's Narishkeit. It can't be that the Torah wanted us to live in the state of Israel without it being well protected and having, you know, these kinds of things. You know, another example is operating electricity on Shabbat. You know, there's a big debate around this because if, say, in some sectors of the Haredi community in Israel, the question has been raised in terms of deriving benefit from the electricity that was operated by fellow Jews on Shabbat, because they're there operating. You know, it's a little more automated these days, a little bit of a different system, less practical. But last couple of decades, that was real, very real. You know, it's not like what do you want? Like a Jewish state, but like we have to bring in, you know, non-Jews in order for a Jewish state to operate. No, this was supposed to be a Jewish state. So his Zionist vision had real living halachic ramifications. He viewed these things as the collective laws, as qualitatively different from others and qualitatively different from individual laws. That's how he saw it. See, that's what he says. So the way he puts it here, he says, regarding the great rule of the laws of Pikuach Nefesh established by the two golden pipes, so it's a rabbinic appellation, i.e. the Nodu Yehid Nechatam Sofer, so the strict sources we saw earlier, that it is only considered Pikuach Nefesh when there is a sick person before us and not when it is possible that a problem of Pikuach Nefesh will arise in the future. This is the hinge upon which our difficult question revolves. It says, it seems that this rule is only valid the cases and questions presented to the Nodi and the Chatam Sofer, where the problem of the health of the nation in general was not a factor. Fascinating. It's a different kind of halakhic calculus altogether. But in our case, when the state and the nation are responsible for the continuity of medical service in Israel, for the health of the people living in the country, and we know from the outset that in another few years we will need a certain number of doctors of high caliber in order to ensure the health of the people, and if we do not maintain medical schools, the country will be left without doctors. Right? So no Jewish doctors? That can't be. Heard it from Rav Gora. It's clear to us that without autopsies performed in medical schools, we will not be able to produce doctors worthy of that name. This is called the sick person is before us. This is Rav Gora at his best. Unbelievable. I can debate it. But this is how he thought about these things. Since the Jewish state is responsible for the health of the population, must plan its services for the long term. It cannot be that we have a Jewish nation that's not able to function without medical institutions. It's just essential to what it means to build a Jewish state. This is awesome. So this is the second view.
Practical application.
What?
Practical application.
Right. It's like the living conception of Jewish law.
He was a nationalist.
So
he always saw the big
picture. Yeah. 100%. And he saw halacha as an essential part of that fabric. And it really, it's a revolution. You know, and you think about these things, it's just you're looking at these halachot and it comes through a completely different lens, you know. And when it comes to laws of war, he said, don't apply the everyday laws of, you know, of one person threatening the life of another. That's the wrong paradigm. Hmm. Says you need a paradigm shift. These are the laws of war. These are the laws of a nation state. That's the proper frame for these kinds of questions. And it's just a completely different kind of set of questions. And you know what he said? We need to rediscover these laws. Because we've been talking about individual scenarios for the last 2,000 years, a diaspora halakha. It was necessary, it's an essential part of how we look at things, but we need to recover the laws of the state. Fascinating.
Going back to our initial discussions of the nature of ethics, so it seems to me that this seems to bring up the ethics of intention, and the previous one also, that mm-hmm. if the intention is not to disgrace the body, mm-hmm. and if the intention is to gain knowledge, mm-hmm. and if the intention is to protect the nation, etc., etc.,
mm-hmm.
so it's ethically permissible because this is judging ethics on intention rather than on outcome per se, in the mm-hmm. sense of, well, you're disfiguring the body.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you're saying that.
But he might argue that it's possible. I think about that more, but maybe. Good. All right, so those are the basic lines of thought. You have those who start from the Nodu Yehid Nechatam Sofer and think that it applies in the same way, but then you have the others, like Rav Uziel and Rav Gora, and this minority view, but I think a potent minority view that views it quite differently. And then we were asking about the question of Jews and Gentiles. So this is a hotly disputed issue, and to some extent goes back to the Torah itself. We mentioned that some of the laws of that are relevant and pertinent for this discussion come from the obligation of burial. And those appear in Source 10, where the Torah says, Lo talin nivo, is talking about someone who's executed, put to death. Even so, we treat this body with tremendous tremendous sanctity, with tremendous reverence in the Jewish tradition. Very important in the Torah, and this is a way, among other things, of distinguishing Jews from the Gentile. Abhorrent Gentile practices, don't do like that. We may put someone to death, it might be capital punishment, but the body needs to be treated with that sanctity. And the Torah has this unusual formulation, it says, Lo talin nivlato al ha'etz, do not leave the corpse remain on the stake overnight, ki kavor tikburenu bayom ha'hu. Don't leave it until past sundown. Bury that day. Ki kilat Elohim taloi. That's a very ambiguous phrase. We'll come back to it in a moment. The accursed one of God is it's hanging, whatever that means. Don't defile the land that your God, the Lord your God, is giving you to possess. The question is this awkward phraseology of the hanged is a curse of God. What does that mean? So Rashi on the spot quotes a classic midrash, and basically he says something that theologically sounds quite challenging, but it's quite relevant for our topic. Rashi says this is a mashal, it's a parable to the son of a king. And he said when people see the son of the king, if there is a degrading of the son of the king, this also reflects in turn on the king himself, right? The prince has something of the physical appearance of his father. And therefore, if someone in the kingdom is to mistreat or otherwise degrade the king's son, the prince, that is a reflection ultimately on the king and thereby is to sully the reputation of the king himself, as it were. Rashi says, so too when it comes to the Jewish people and God. We are created of God or something like that. We are children of God. We're compared to that. And so therefore, basically, if you were to disgrace the body, the corpse, even a person who has been put to death, nonetheless, this Jewish individual is considered to be God's child. To disgrace this body is considered to be a disgrace of God. Theologically, it's complex because it sounds from Rashi like he's saying that it's because the child and the father share physical characteristics. So what does that mean? You know, Tzelem Elohim is a metaphor. We're created in the image of God, but don't seem to say that we have share physical characteristics. So how do you handle that becomes its own separate discussion. But what do we see from Rashi? That this verse, which is the source of not desecrating the body and the positive obligation to bury on the same day and so on and so forth, the laws of respect for a corpse, this is the sort of the major source for that, the locus classicus, as we say. Rashi invokes a metaphor specific to the children of God, and Rashi makes it clear that he's talking about Yisrael, Jewish people. Rashi seems to imply that these laws are particularly relevant or maybe only apply to a Jewish corpse. The Ramban, source 12, pushes back. He says, that's just wrong. He says, the parable of two twin brothers contains a secret. The Ramban was, of course, a Kabbalist. He was a mystic. He has all Kabbalistic explanation. He says, I'm not going to tell you all of that right now. All right, I'm going to leave that only for the initiated. Right? We're not going to put that out there. Right? He would have been probably uncomfortable with the Hollywood forms of Kabbalah institutes and all that, but that's a separate discussion. He says, unlike the rabbi, and I was referring to Rashi, thought that it regards Israel, who are called children to God. In other words, for Rashi, these verses refer specifically to the Jewish people. Nachman is Ramban. Pushes back. He says, no, these laws of disgracing a dead body, they apply equally to Jews and Gentiles alike. And this debate becomes the basis for a more recent debate. Rav Kook, first chief rabbi of Mandate Palestine, who's generally viewed as a very progressive individual, and in some ways conceptually was, it's easy to simplify his legacy. And he had a number of positions that were complicated, and I think we have to recognize that and to see that as part of who he was. One in terms of women's issues, a separate discussion. He was actually opposed to women's suffrage when it was becoming a major debate at that time. And that's a whole sugya in its own right. And his contemporaries were shocked, and they disagreed with him in the Mizrahi movement. Said, sorry, Rukuk, we're not going with this. And others, a very interesting debate when these issues became to be they were very practical, the very first parts of the 20th century. It's sometimes easy to forget how recently women gained suffrage. Very interesting. This one is about the autopsy issues before the founding of the city dies in 1935, but in Mandate Palestine, these questions came up, and they were asking about all these kinds of questions to Rav Kook, and he says in his perspective, basically Rashi's, right? And he says, therefore, instead of performing autopsies and dissections on Jewish corpses, we have to be willing to pay almost any amount of money to procure Gentile corpses for the medical schools in Israel. That's what he said. In my opinion, since the desecration of the corpse is one of the unique prohibitions for Jewish people, for God commanded us in the body's sanctity, we must pay full money for Gentile corpses for the purpose of research. And others pushed back. Rav Soloveitchik disagreed very strongly. He said, no, wait a second. The founder, and Rav Uziel in his way, they both disagreed, and they said, that's wrong. He said, in our opinion, Ramban is right. And here's how I know Ramban is right. Number one, they thought it's the majority position. Number two, it's rooted in the idea of Tzelem Elokim. Look back at Breshit, right? Adam Harishon, right? How Jewish was he? On a scale of 1 to 10. Not very. Okay? Not very. All human beings are created in the image of God. And so this goes to the questions of essentialism, and there's a Mishnah on Pirkei Avot that touches on this in the whole literature. But each in their own way, Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Uziel, Soloveitchik seemed to say you couldn't do, actually he seemed to be very strict on this. He said you have to equate between them, and you couldn't even do the autopsy dissection on non-Jewish bodies. See, there's no difference. Rav Uziel says, no, you do Jewish or Gentiles. But they both said this is the idea of Tzelem Elokim. So this was a very hot dispute. Okay, last two things that I wanted to share are as follows. So we have all these debates. Well, how do they settle? So I gave you some of the practical rulings. He has a little bit more, but I gave you most of what the Tzitz Eliezer gives us as his bottom line policy for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, which is sensitive to all of these and in a way is sort of an intermediary practical position, not so much on the Jewish-Gentile question, but in the practical side. So just to quickly run through his practical point, and then I'll close with one more insight from the Nishmat Avraham, which is from a monkey wrench in the whole question. I am going to close with a monkey wrench, but I think it actually tells us something very beautiful and powerful about our whole approach in philosophy to medical ethics. It won't leave us unsettled, but I think it'll leave us with something powerful. He says, number one, says Tzitz Eliezer, opening bodies for the sake of pathology, where the cause of death is unknown and there are ramifications for punishment. Wow. And again, my purpose is not to give us practical halacha, but it touches on the case that we were discussing at the outset. And again, you know, these are obviously questions that must be asked to a rabbi, to your LOR, as we say. Your local Orthodox rabbi? Anyone familiar with the L-O-R, they say. L-O-R. Rabbi Sachs was talking to high school students. He said, are you familiar with FOMO? Do you know FOMO? F-O-M-O. Fear of missing out. The digital age, you know, everyone has FOMO all the time. So did you have FOMO? So that's number one. That's pretty striking. He's saying there is room to permit this he's not saying merely in order to learn about that individual. That is not saying. That's important to grant here. But he says if it's, you know, if it's like the Gemara talked about in Chulin, if there are ramifications for punishment of a murderer or something, if there's a contemporary case, it comes before Beit Din, and we're trying to figure out it goes up to the Supreme Court in Israel or something, you know, those kinds of scenarios are very difficult. That wouldn't be. But in these kinds of questions that go to high courts, and we have to find out, is there's room halachically to permit autopsy in order to find out, you know, what was the cause of death? In a complicated kind of case, that's one. In a criminal trial rather, that's one. A, B. When we permit dissection of the corpse if he died from an illness whose cure is not fully understood, in order to glean knowledge from this to cure other patients stricken from this disease. Very interesting. That was his policy. Again, I'm not saying these are standards. These are hotly debated, all of these, but this is what he says. Similarly, there's room to permit one to dissect the corpse, even if there are no patients present now, if the deceased sold himself for this purpose, right, or gave permission, or forgave his honor for this purpose. In other words, the relatives, it's not so simple. But actually, now he's not saying for long term or something like that, but if there is room to derive immediate medical knowledge, That was the ruling in Tzitzel Eliezer, very striking. D, there's no permissibility to perform a dissection simply for the reason that there are no relatives who demand that the body be buried whole. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in other words, the fact that there are no relatives who are saying we must do this, and the doctors say, okay, this is our opportunity, he says, no, not so fast. He says, that's not something that's up to the doctors. And by the way, this is an aside, this goes to the questions of autonomy. In Jewish medical ethics, usually they say, well, secular medical ethics, pro-autonomy. Jewish medical ethics, anti-autonomy. Not so simple. Much more subtle than that. Sure, there are fundamental differences. That's absolutely true. But that doesn't mean that there are not gray areas or instances in which Jewish medical ethics allow for a certain degree of latitude. A professor at a Columbia, now Yeshiva University, Dr. David Schatz, has written about this. He's a philosopher. He's one of the, I like to say he's the funny philosopher. Okay, aren't too many funny philosophers with respect to philosophers. You can say it about rabbis. He likes to say it about philosophers. I'll let him say it. But he's very quite humorous. And he also has written about this, that it's an oversimplification. Ultimately, there are core differences, but that doesn't mean that there are no realms of latitude. Similarly, E, the forgiveness of the relatives does not work to permit the autopsy, as we said. He says, if in a complex scenario where there's an illness the physicians do not fully understand, we don't know the intentions of the deceased, he says, there we might require a panel, rabbis, medical ethicists, etc. He says, his language is a broad panel of rabbis, but it's only those who are knowledgeable medically as well, who join together to permit this matter. Very interesting. And then he says, but that's for a very quick test. We're talking about something short term, but to just hold on to a body for a long time, he says there's no permissibility for that. That's number 9 over here. He says there's no consent in the world. Next side, last page. There's no consent in the world that can permit this. So the Jeremy Bentham case, or even less long term than that, he said that that's clearly against everything that we said. Very striking.
But
it's very late, but.
But impalement or hanging from a tree is not the same as the way the bodies are preserved now.
Mm-hmm.
So doesn't seem like it's quite analogous.
Right, but he's talking about now, and he's just saying that that's already a disgrace that we would not countenance. A short-term medical battery of tests would be one thing, but just to preserve for science for posterity.
Oh, no, not forever.
Whatever. I don't know how he defines long-term.
Okay.
Good question. But I think it's very striking. All of this is to say that the laws of autopsy are more complex than we might otherwise think, and it's interesting that there are voices that we don't always hear. Again, my point is not to rule on this, but you know, any Israel might be different than America. I think it's important to say as well. The last point here that's relevant is the Nishmat Avram, who's a doctor, makes the point that nowadays we can learn a lot more than they used to be able without actual dissection. It is no longer the standard, he doesn't quite say it this way, but it's no longer, he says, for certification and among hospital organizations, larger organizations, he says, it's no longer essential or necessary that you have dissection research taking place in the hospital. And we can say analogously that in medical schools, there's a trend toward virtual study, virtual anatomy. Some of the leading medical schools have moved toward, and it's not considered. And there's a major debate, actually. Some say no, we need it for the ethical side, for the humanity purpose, to educate to our compassion. And others say no, that was once we had no choice but to dismember a body. We said let's make this as humane as possible, but we wouldn't have chosen in a vacuum to actually take apart a human corpse just in order to teach that sensitivity. We teach that around living human beings and real patients, and we would do this virtually if we can, which I think there's a lot to be said for that. But he makes the point that we need to reevaluate this nowadays, that it might have previously been necessary. And he adds, I don't know if it's in this episode, he says, we also know a lot more. We have to be honest about how, you know, diminishing returns. There comes a point at which, you know, we now have gotten to a point in the 21st century where we know a lot more. It's not necessary, it's essential for the advance of medical knowledge. And I think that although this is practically a monkey wrench in terms of how often we'll be willing to permit autopsies as a matter of halachic practice, because now things might look different than they did even in the 20th century, I think there's a powerful statement here, which is that halachic medical ethics is about the fusion of halacha, that sense of compassion and humanism, and a cutting-edge knowledge of the facts on the ground, and that what was true 10 years ago might look very different nowadays. And unless rabbis have current medical knowledge, what might have been necessary a long time ago might be passé, and now might be counterproductive or no longer really valuable in the same way. And we need to, and we do, keep abreast of the medical knowledge in order to rule. And that's why having someone like this, who is a rabbi and a medical doctor, to be able to fuse those domains is essential, is a great exemplar of what it means to put these together. And so I think looking at all of this, we see that this is a more complex matter, that halakha is always about balancing these difficult but critical considerations in all the different directions, that there has been legitimate debate around this for very many, many, many years. Continues to be a hotly disputed topic. And even according to Eliezer, just to find out the cause of death might still be problematic, but that's, you know, that needs to be put out there. But also that the mandate and that this value of keeping up with the medical knowledge, that's essential to be knowledgeable. Just like the members of the Sanhedrin had to know the 70 language in order to know their stuff, I think continues to be an essential part of the picture. So that's, I think, is an inspiring charge for rabbis and for all of us too, in all of our areas, to continue to learn. Last night, Rabbi Sachs mentioned he had seven ways that we as a Jewish community teach anti-fragility, resilience, if you want to put it that way. And one of them is to be lifelong learners. And I commend all of you for being indeed lifelong learners and to modeling that for our students and for our community. So it's always deeply appreciated. I look forward to picking up next week, and we will go from there. Yashar Kwan.